Welcome to the Bitches Be Brave podcast. We know how difficult and crazy it can be to juggle family, career, and not to mention make time for yourself as a busy working mom.
So it's time to get inspired and gain the tools to create a life you love. We are your hosts, Bev Steele
and Heather Hobbs.
Join us as together we motivate, inspire, and gain tools to thrive in all areas of life. Let's go.
Welcome to this episode of Bitches Be Brave. On today's episode, we interview Miriam Feldman, who is the author of He Came In With It. And we talk about being a mother to a child with schizophrenia. And Miriam's story is definitely a touching story that I think as we explored today, is not only really a story about having a child with schizophrenia or mental illness, but it's really about, you know, showing the truth about exposing what happens in families and when your life maybe isn't what you necessarily thought it was going to be, and how as moms, you know, we need to learn to accept that and change with it. And we can't always control everything that happens. And this was to me a real touching interview. And I love her sincerity and her authenticity.
Yeah, we as moms, I think, you know, we have these babies and we think we're going to mold them and guide them to this beautiful, happy life. And, you know, there's always a realization where, you know, your child is going to be who they are. And her story just resonated so much with me. You know, there's so much fear, I think, in allowing your child to be who they are because you really want them to be happy. You want them to have, you know, everything really. And all the success in the world, and just really her story of acceptance, meeting her child where he was at. Although, you know, the story to get there was obviously challenging. I think it will resonate with all of us.
And overcoming so much. I mean, it's truly a story of triumph. And it's, you know, I think it's always ongoing, but I think when you look at what she's been through and what going through and having a child with any sort of challenges really can put a big, you know, divide in your marriage and in your family. But to see her come out, you know, on the other side of that and have kept her marriage intact and kept her family intact. It's amazing to see.
Yeah, I think everyone will get a lot out of this. I know I did. And we hope you enjoy it.
Here we go.
So here we go.
Hey guys, we're just taking a quick break to tell you about an amazing new wine that we just discovered. You guys know that nobody loves a glass of wine more than we do. But when we learned what is actually in the wine that we were drinking, we were shocked. No wonder we were getting headaches, brain fog, and having trouble sleeping.
That's right, Heather, but then we discovered Dry Farm Wines. Dry Farm Wines are organically crafted, unprocessed wine free of sugar, additives, and lower in alcohol. These wines are amazing, and they're better for our bodies and our planet. Now we can enjoy the pleasure and euphoria of wine without the negative effects of higher alcohol consumption.
To find out where you can try these amazing wines and get a special Bitches Be Brave discount, click on the link in our show notes below. Welcome. We are here today with Miriam Feldman, who's an artist, writer, and mental health activist. She's the mom of four, and when her son Nick was diagnosed in 2004, Miriam became an activist and a writer. With firsthand knowledge of our mental health system, she decided to be an advocate for those who have no voice. She serves on the advisory board of Bring Change to Mind, the nonprofit founded by Glenn Close, and writes a monthly blog for their website. Miriam is in active leadership at NAMI Washington and writes for their newsletters. She's a frequent guest on mental health podcasts and is active on Instagram, where she has a community of family and loved ones dealing with mental illness. Miriam, we're so excited to have you on the podcast today because I think this is it's a very relevant topic, and we haven't really talked about this too much on our podcast before, but I know it's something that affects so many families all over the world. And so I'd love for you to tell us about your story and about your family and how you came to publishing it.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. You know, I'm a visual artist. I'm a painter. That's what I've done my whole life. And writing was not something that was in my lexicon. for a long time, but you know, we have four kids. We had pretty average kind of childhood for all of them. And then when my son hit his teen years, things started to happen and we started to have problems. The thing is, if you're to make the list of red flags for serious mental illness and the list of normal teenage behavior, you'd have virtually the same list. Yeah. So it's very confusing in the beginning because they're all mercurial, they're all rebellious, they're all not making sense, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so you look at them and you think, okay, well, this is what teenagers are like. And so we went for a couple of years just assuming this was normal. But then as time went on, his problems seemed to get more serious and the kids around him seemed to be moving forward in their evolution and their maturing. And we started to realize something more was going on here than regular teenage stuff. And what happened with Nick was there was a suicide attempt. So of course, when that happened, it was clear that this was very serious and not normal teenage behavior. And at that point, we started the therapy route. We thought in the beginning that it was drug related because he was smoking pot and doing some drugs. And I've since learned, since I've educated myself over the past 15 years, that it's very common with the onset of a disease like schizophrenia that they turn to drugs because they start self-medicating because he's hearing voices in his head. Reality isn't the way other people are perceiving it. And, you know, he didn't have the tools to talk about it. So he was trying to manage it. So for a couple of years, we dealt with it first as a drug problem and sent him to rehabs and things like that. Then when we started to realize it was deeper than that, more organic than that, he started seeing therapists. It was first diagnosed as depression and then anxiety. And then after that, eventually when he was about 18 or 19, they said bipolar. And finally, when he was 20, he got the diagnosis of schizophrenia. So it was this horrible long road of not knowing what was going on, not being able to manage or control anything, our lives being completely out of control. And it's just, it's a hard diagnosis to receive, but it's also a hard diagnosis to get to. Serious mental illness is like a gale force hurricane that just blows through your life. And anything that's not firmly nailed down is just gone. And so you wake up one day and you just find yourself standing there in this empty place and everything you believe to be true is in question now. And it's the starting point for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I just, you know, reading your story, I was struck when you said the age of your son, and I had to calculate back at the age on where he was diagnosed. I thought, wow, that seemed very late. Were there things that were happening along the way that you thought maybe, oh, that's something, but I'm going to ignore it? Or what happened to get to that process?
There were things like that. I mean, again, you have this problem of normal teenage behavior. And you know, as a mother, I think as a human being, you just have a inclination to normalize things and to not want to think it's the worst thing. So I think we did a lot of that, a lot of normalizing it. But, you know, Nick's first 15 years, he was the dream child. You know, he was gorgeous and funny and smart, had a million friends, and was a prodigious artist. He was on track to be kind of a, you know, world-changing artist. He was amazing. And I fell in love with, I think like we all do to some degree, and when you get a golden boy like this, maybe even more, I just fell in love with what I saw his future to be. And it was so hard for me, it's still, you know, he's 34 and it's still hard for me to let go of what I thought his life was going to be. And I think that that's something that all mothers and parents in general can relate to. And with Nick, that was particularly hard. And especially when the thing that he excelled in, being an artist, was something that comes along with not being normal, you know, and not being run of the mill, being eccentric. I kept trying to put things in that category of, oh, well, he's just an artist, you know, he's just different from the other kids. So I was in denial for a long time. And then once we knew we were dealing with mental issues, then I went into the phase of, for years, trying to hide it until I can fix it. And I was convinced that I was going to be able to fix everything. If everybody would just leave me alone, I was going to fix it. And once I realized that that wasn't going to happen, that was a whole nother phase of my life, which is kind of where I am now. But it was just very hard to identify. You know, it's mm-hmm. just questionable every step of the way, because there's not a blood test where they say, mm-hmm. you know, okay, this is what it is.
I think that's the hardest part. And, you know, reading your story, and I know even, you know, different, but in a similar way, I have a son who's on the spectrum, and I always call it the puzzle. I have had just to put pieces of the puzzle together to find out that it's the wrong puzzle, and then start over with pieces to the puzzle and build and take down. And it's, there's no great, you know, system to help you through this, I think. And part of it may be because, like you said, we're somewhat in denial. You kind of think, well, I'm going to just put him on a healthy diet and cut out sugar, and that will help things, or I'm going to try, you know. And so there's so many different roads that we take. And, you know, looking back on your life, I mean, I know it's, you just said it's a really hard thing to do. There's not a blood test to just diagnose, but if you were to go back to the start of this, you know, is there something you would say, this is what I would recommend to families going through this now?
You know, I get asked that a lot, and it's a tricky question, because the thing about mental illness, especially schizophrenia, is it's bespoke for each lucky recipient. You know, it manifests differently for everybody. And so I'm very cautious when it comes to giving advice. But one piece of advice that I am very comfortable in giving is, you can't overreact. You know, always err on the side of think it's more serious than it is, because if I have any regrets, it would be normalizing, because you have this window of time when they're in their teens, before they turn 18, where you have control of their bodies, you know, and you have control of what they do, and you can, that's this incredible window to get them good treatment. And I lost most of that because I was normalizing. And then when we realized it was serious, he had already turned 18. So then I was finding a whole nother battle, which was coercing him, bribing him, doing what I could to get him to take treatment. So I think that, you know, I think as parents, if you overreact and you take it too seriously and it turns out it's not mental illness and they're fine, well, yay, have a party.
Right.
But if you err on the other side of that, you lose precious time.
Yeah, I think, speaking for myself as a mom, you also worry about making too big a deal about it, and then he's going to feel bad about himself. I mean, I can just hear the different conversations and struggle that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's a very tough road, I am sure, but I've heard that again and again, that the earlier you can get your child in, the better, because after 18, you know, they are an adult.
And then you fight this battle the rest of your life, because he needs just as much help now, if not more. And you know, I'm lucky because Nick is compliant and he's engaged with his own treatment. But you know, I used to drive around and I would see, you know, the homeless guy on the corner who's screaming at somebody who's not there and obviously seriously mentally ill, and I would think, where's his mother?
I always think,
how does this happen? Why isn't she taking care of him? But now I understand. You know, I have, I have a certain amount of privilege. I have a college education. We are, you know, middle class. We have a decent amount of money. And it almost took me down. And on top of all of that, I'm a pit bull. I mean, I don't give up. And on top of all of that, it was almost impossible to manage. And I think of people who don't have the resources or the help that I had, of course, at some point, it just slips through your fingers.
Yeah. And I want to talk about and kind of shift gears, I guess, two key things. But one is I read in your book, and I had made a note about this because I remember thinking the same just with my own son, but about you go through a phase where you go, was it me? Was it something I took or drank in pregnancy? Was it something, you know, is it somehow my fault? And I think we almost as women maybe intuitively put that on ourselves because we created them in our belly, you know? So, and talk about that. Cause I know you mentioned that just kind of going through a little bit of that self blame in the beginning.
A little bit, a lot. And honestly, in my head, I have dismissed that, but it still lives with me. I mean, there are those late night lying in bed and I start doing this, you know, for years I did just a frenzy excavation of every minute of his life from the moment I knew I was pregnant. And yeah, of course you blame yourself. I mean, we grew them in our bellies, like yeah. You said. And so I spent a lot of time blaming myself. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what was the thing, what was the onset, what was the thing that triggered it. And you know, now at this point, 12 years into it, I have some scenarios, some ideas of things that did contribute to it and places and times where, God, I wish I'd known better or I wish I'd known more, but I didn't. But the thing is, it's not something I can control and it's not something that they can put a finger to how it happened. You know, I think back on a couple things, like specific moments. There was a moment when Nick was about 16 when he'd broken up with a girl and he was sad. And I remember sitting on his bed and he's lying on his bed and, you know, I was talking to him about this girl and, you know, trying to give him the typical pep talk and tell him how there'll be so many more girls and this will be just a blip on the radar. And at one point in the conversation, he looked at me and says, Mom, I just have so many bad thoughts. I have just so many horrible thoughts in my head and voices in my head. And, you know, I gave him what I thought was a perfectly adequate response. And I said, you know, don't worry about your thoughts. Everybody has weird thoughts. We're not responsible for our thoughts in the way we're responsible for actions. What matters is what you do. You know, don't beat yourself up over having weird thoughts. And I think back on it now, it's like he was telling me he was hearing voices. But I had no way to identify that at the moment. It's not something that was even in my sphere of thinking. But I think of that and I think, and so what did I tell him? You know, oh, it doesn't matter what you think. You know, it's like, great, great advice for a kid developing schizophrenia, but how was I to know? So I've had to forgive myself. You know, I just had to forgive myself.
I mean, I think that's the thing. If you have never grown up with a history of this in your family, I mean, every day is a brand new day. And not to mention, we're all, you know, I always tell my oldest, I'm like, every single day is a new day of me being a mom to whatever age you are today. Like, never done this before, you know, it's all new. And especially when you're dealing with something like that. Yeah, it's tough. And I wanted to ask you the second part of that is, I know firsthand, I mean, I've heard the statistics that families and marriages specifically that have any sort of child with any sort of special needs has almost an 80% chance of divorce. How has this illness, because we haven't really talked about your daughters yet, how has this illness affected your family, your girls and your husband and, you know, your marriage?
You know, immensely, drastically, it changed everything. It's very difficult for his sisters and different for each one because he's an older sister and two younger sisters. So each one's experience is completely different and they're quite spread out in their age. So, you know, my littlest one was 9 when this started. So this was kind of the only Nick she ever knew. So she has an easier time accepting this and not hanging on to what should have been. My middle girl, Lucy, it was dreadful. He was like her North Star. He was her mentor and her hero. And, you know, she lost the guy who was introducing her to the world. And, you know, everybody is reckoning with that now. And it was also incredibly hard on the marriage. You know, when I would go to the NAMI meetings, the National Alliance for Mental Illness, and you know, I would look around the room and there would always, it would always be one or the other parents or mostly mothers, but very rarely were there two parents together. And my husband never went to any of these things with me. You know, his way of dealing with it was for many, many years, denial and not wanting to deal with it and pulling back and, you know, disengaging with all of us. And that then in turn was horrible on the girls because they lost their dad and their brother. But there was just a point in the middle of all of it where I sort of, you know, I just stood there and I thought, you know, I haven't worked so hard for so long to build this family that I adore to have it taken down by schizophrenia. And I'm not going to let that happen. And I'm not taking credit for the fact that it didn't happen, but, you know, little credit maybe. But I mean, the reason why it didn't happen is we have tremendous love. And that's what maintained it and held it together. And there were really bad times. I mean, you know, as you saw in the book, there were years when my husband was living in Washington, basically, and I was living here. You know, it took a tremendous toll, but here we are and everybody's an adult and we're a good, strong family now. And I'm grateful for that.
Well, can you share?
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, can you share with our listeners, you know, what were some of the tools that you attribute to that success to?
You know, one of the big things for me personally was beginning to embrace and understand the concept of acceptance. You know, like I said, I was trying to fix it for so long and, you know, it's unfixable. So I was just butting up against the brick wall and it was doing no good and it was debilitating me. And at one point, you know, I was running around trying to manage running a business and all my employees and my three daughters and my crazy son and my marriage falling apart. And I just, you know, I didn't process too much in terms of feelings at that point. I just was trying to function. And then at night I would go into, after everybody was settled, I'd go in the bathroom and I'd run the shower and I would lie on the floor and cry. But I didn't want the girls to see me cry, which also, as an aside, is a big mistake because they know what's going on anyway. And one night I walked out of the bathroom and I was confronted by my youngest daughter, and it was obvious I was crying. There was no way I was going to deny it. And she said to me, "Mom, why are you crying?" And I said, "I'm crying because I miss your brother." And she said to me, "What do you mean you miss Nick? Nick's not gone. Nick's here." And I said, "Yeah, but he's not who he was supposed to be." She looked me in the eye and she said, "Yeah, he is. It's just not what you thought." Mm-hmm. And it was like, boom.
Yeah.
And she just turned and walked into a room and I sat down in the window seat and it was like I got hit by an anvil. And I sat down and thought, okay. And that was the beginning of the change, you know, from the mouths of babes. She was 9 years old. And I started to accept that this is how he came to us. It may not have been what I could identify or see at the time when he was a baby or through his childhood, but he's not a different person. This is who I grew in my belly. This is how he came to us. And it's my job to love who he is and take care of him. Mm-hmm. And all the energy that I'm spending dreaming about and railing against, you know, what happened to take him away from what he was supposed to be is energy that I could be spending loving my family and taking care of myself and finding solutions. And I just actively started at that point trying to check myself. You know, it's a hard thing. You can't. I mean, I still do it. I mean, there's no way that you don't have moments where you're just howling at the moon. This is such a tragic and unfair thing to happen to a human being, and then it's your child. It's a hard thing to accept, but that was the point at which I started working on accepting, and it's helpful.
I think that's a lesson for every mom to hear, because, you know, we want better for our kids. We all want better for our kids, and we start at, you know, the very beginning. We're going to have them do this and this, all these things that we want for them. And then when they make a turn that, you know, they're pivoting to another direction, you know, for us to try to struggle to make them what we think will make them happy is not, is not going to be. So accepting your child where they're at and for who they are is so important to hear.
And it's also, I think, because I kind of had an enlightening moment years ago as well when I was struggling, because I have a sister who has four kids and she's like an angel. She's Mother Teresa. She like doesn't lose her patience over anything. And I remember one time going, oh my God, like, you know, not to be religious or spiritual, it's no matter, you know, who or what you believe in, but it's like, why was I given this challenge? Like my sister would have been a much better mother to handle these situations. And that was when I had this epiphany, like, this is my challenge. Like this is my, you know, the task that I think I was granted on this earth was, I'm very type A. I'm very controlling. Bev is like, yes, 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 yes. But I like to control things and I cannot control, you know, the situation with a child who has challenges. And so I know that was a real, and I, you know, the same thing, I fail still to this day, every single day. But I think when I bring myself back to that place of he is here for a reason and he's my child for a reason. And I love when you talk about too, because this was a big awakening for myself is, you know, I grew up, I'm very social. And so to me, like, I would never want to sit and eat just alone. Like I want friends. And if I see someone alone, I'm like, come sit with me. Whereas my son is happy being alone. And I had to like, and I know you wrote about that. And then I'd love to hear you talk about it. Just like when you have to say, okay, finding groups or support groups or social groups, like isn't necessarily what Nick wants. It's what you think.
Yeah, you have to meet them where they are, you know? And it's interesting because I'm hearing from lots of mothers who have similar situations with their kids, but I'm also, the book is resonating for any mother. You know, this is sort of like the challenges of being a mother on steroids, but it's the same issues. You know, it's the same thing of accepting them and not imposing what you want onto how they are, and this is the extreme version of this. You know, what you said about your sister and all of that, it resonates for me as well. You know, I remember when my kids were young, walking on the street with my four perfect kids, you know, I mean, they would never sick a day. I mean, Nick always used to get the perfect attendance prize every year in school. I mean, they literally were the perfect kids. And I would see a mom with a kid in a wheelchair who has MS or one of these diseases where they're so limited and they have to be so taken care of. And I would look at that mom and I would think to myself, I can never do that. I couldn't do it. And then Nick got sick and I realized, of course I would be able to do it. We all would. I mean, it's your kid. You step up to the base and you do what you have to do. And that was a real revelation for me in terms of what I have. Because I'm like you described yourself, type A, fix it, you know. And also, then there's a certain ego attached to that too, because it's like, we're going to fix it and it's going to be beautiful. And then we're going to put it out there for everybody to see and everybody's going to be impressed. And I mean, honestly, that is part of it, at least was for me in the past. And this situation also completely decimated that. You know, what people think, I mean, that's what I always say about having a kid with schizophrenia, the one good benefit to it is you become officially embarrassment proof. There's nothing that can happen that will embarrass me. I mean, once you've had the police numerous times and, you know, the helicopters above and, you know, in your nice middle class neighborhood, dragging your screaming kid off and, you know, one thing after another like that, it's like, I'm impervious. There's nothing that embarrasses me. It's changed. I mean, there's a nice freedom in that, at least.
Yeah.
That's good. Just get it over with and then everything else is easy, right?
Yeah.
I'm interested just to hear a little bit about Nick's art. You know, you said that he was a budding artist, and has he continued to do his art, and how did that transform through before he was diagnosed and after into today?
It's interesting. Like I said, he was really prodigious. You know, he, from the very beginning, when he was very little, I mean, I would see the other parents at the open house at school, like looking at his work and whispering to each other. And, you know, I'm an artist, my husband's an artist, and all of our kids are artistic, but Nick stood out. I mean, Nick, it was different. I could see at a very early age that he had an immense talent. And so all through his life until he got sick, it was just this expression of how amazing he was. When he got sick, the art became, his drawings and his paintings became darker and a little bit scary. And I actually remember at one point taking a birthday card that he had drawn for me because it was disturbing and sending it to the doctor for him to see, and the doctor getting back to me and saying, yeah, this is something, we gotta address this. So it was in a sense, the door into what was going on in his head. Then, so it was really wild and you know, out of control, his art making and everything for the first few years of him being sick. And then by the time he was finally diagnosed with schizophrenia and into his early 20s, he just stopped. And so for years he did nothing, which broke my husband and my hearts. But again, that's like our expectations, you know. During those years, he was fairly content, but he was so drugged up, he was like a zombie. Then eventually he started drawing again, and what he did for many years is draw and color in books. He would draw in like Hello Kitty and, you know, Teenage Ninja Turtle, like the coloring books that were from when he was a kid. And at first I found that very depressing, but then I realized that what it was an indication of how powerful the urge, the drive, to draw and paint was in him. Because I'm like that. Every day of my life I paint. Since I could hold something in my hand, it was a paintbrush. So I get it. And I don't even care if I'm rolling a wall white or I'm painting a painting. I just need to be painting. So once I realized that that's what that was about, I was okay with it. Which is fine, because I don't need to be okay with it. It's not my thing. But you know, I identified it as something nice. In the last year or so, he started painting again. So it's very exciting, and we're waiting to see, you know, how this all develops. But he started doing his own paintings.
I'd love to hear that. And I, you know, I just want to say, I just think what you're doing and being a voice to so many families out there who may be going through this. And, you know, you talked about it a bit ago. It's like, you're finally out there. There's nothing that can embarrass you. You're embarrassment proof. And, you know, I've seen you, I heard you write that you said, you know, screw stigma. It's imperative to stop caring about other people's opinions and just to kind of be open and honest. And I think that's where you find your support. And I think, you know, that's so key right there, because for so long, I think we try to keep this like facade of normalcy. But once you're free and talk about how the truth is nobody's really normal. Like nobody, I think nobody's life is really all that it seems to be.
That is true.
And I think it's so much more freeing, and you know, you can almost skip over the judgment piece when you're blatant, I find, with whatever is happening in your life. It's like, forget now, you know, don't even bother judging. Here's what's happening in our family.
Go ahead and judge. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, one of my main thrust in writing this book was when this all started, I remember I would sit inside my house and look out the big picture window in the living room, and I would look at all the houses up and down the street and think everybody has this normal, clean, you know, I really felt this sort of delineation of clean and dirty. I felt like I had like this dirty thing behind my front door, and everybody else's life was copacetic and clean and fine, and I had this bad secret. Well, once I abandoned that and started talking about it, I realized, first of all, that you said nobody's life is what it seems to be, and also virtually everybody has some connection to mental illness, mental health struggles in some way. I mean, 1 in 4 Americans deal with a mental health condition in their lives. Well, if you extrapolate out those numbers, that means virtually everybody's dealing with it. You know, maybe not serious mental illness like me, but something. And so once you start talking about it, all of a sudden you realize everybody's dying to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wrote the book, so that especially moms who were like me, feeling they had this dreadful, ugly secret, can understand that there's so many families going through this, and they're not alone.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the main reasons why Heather and I started this podcast, is that we really believe that, you know, in our culture, you know, we go to school and we want our kids to look perfect, and, you know, we go to work and we don't want anyone to know what's going on at home. And that we really need to start the conversation, because you are right. You know, we're all struggling. We all have our challenges. I think you said something about blemishes and mistakes are just a part of being human. And so just bravo to you for having a voice here. And I'm sure it's going to resonate with our listeners. So Miriam, how can our listeners find you? How can they find your book?
Well, the book is available everywhere books are. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Goodreads, it's everywhere. And also, shout out for your local independent bookseller, who, all, if they don't have it, you can request it and you can get it there. So it's very easy to find. I have a website, which is lowercase miriam-feldman.com. And on there, you can see I have a blog where I've written about things over the years. Excuse me. And you can see my artwork. You can see Nick's artwork. You can see pictures of the family. There's resources for mental health organizations and things like that. And also there's all kinds of stuff about my business. I had for years a business in LA, painting murals and doing decorative art. So everything's on there. The website's a great place. And I've been getting so many letters from mostly moms, but lots of people. And so far, I've been answering every single letter because I'm so touched that the book is resonating for people. And so I'm perfectly happy for people to reach out and, you know, try and connect and shout out. I'm happy to talk to people or write letters or whatever. And there's also, I'm on Instagram as Mimi the Riveter. And I've trying and working on creating a community of loved ones and people dealing with mental health and just being upbeat and realistic and hopeful about the future.
I love it. I love it. So the last question that we want to ask you is, what does it mean to you to be brave?
You know, it's an interesting question because did another interview. I did a book launch at Powell's Books here in Portland with the author Lydia Yuknovich, who's a phenomenal writer. And she was interviewing me and she asked me, do you feel like writing this book was brave? And it was weird. I didn't expect a question like that. And I thought about it. And I said, you know, I don't feel like it's brave. I'm an art maker. And this is what I've done my whole life. And this book is just another piece of work for me. And so I had to approach it that way. But what I do think is brave, what I consider brave, is accepting what you weren't expecting, accepting other than what you wanted. You know, this is what I learned because I developed a really strong practice of yoga and meditation, which again, for type A personality, is not a thing that you normally would gravitate towards, but I fell into it because I was in such a desperate condition and it saved my life. And the thing is that surrender is something that I always regarded as a sign of weakness, as, you know, the white flag, you're giving up, you've lost. And what I learned through yoga is that surrender is a sign of intelligence. It's a sign of understanding a situation and accepting what you can't change and working with it from there. And that's what I think courage is. And that's what I think being brave is. It's not trying to pound everything into the shape that you want it to be, but moving through and around things that are uncomfortable.
I love it. Got me right here. Accepting what you weren't expecting. That's my mantra today.
And I'm so glad you brought up the meditation and yoga, because that was the one area we didn't even get to today, but self-care. So I love that you're doing that. I know you do talk a lot about that. Miriam, thank you so much for coming on and for sharing your story and your book. And we hope everybody out there, all of our listeners, will go check it out, because I know you're going to touch a lot of lives.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. And I'd like to ask you, if you did, if you could please go to Apple Podcasts and leave a review and a 5-star rating, I hope.
I really would like to get this podcast out to more women, supporting women, and I can't do it without your help. Thanks so much, and be brave.